This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Good morning and welcome to the Indie Media Show. Pumped to be with you. It's been a long time personally. My name is Alex Wisson and super excited to be in the hosting chair for the first time in a while. First of all, thanks so much to Jeff for another fabulous edition of On The Record. What a trooper he is. And I'm joined in the studio by Ewan and Joni. How are we, guys? What's happening?
Yeah, good. Not much, hanging out.
Yep, pretty relaxed. Lovely day outside, I have to say.
Absolutely.
So, no, super excited to be in the chair. Ray is taking a well-deserved break. He will be back soon. He's off on a covert mission on behalf of various... Well, I won't go into it, as I've said too much already. But no, as I say, pleased to be with you on the show, and plenty coming up on the show today. What are we going to be talking about today, Ewan?
I've got a whole bunch of things, Alex. I'm going to be trying out my radio voice, of course. this is a debut for me. Alex is going to be speaking to somebody about the freedom rallies, I believe, that were held over the weekend. I've got a little bit for you wrapping up or summarising some of the amazing Aboriginal rights rally that was held on Thursday protesting this new heritage bill. And we're going to hear a little bit about the Spray Chalk Six notorious criminals apprehended by a state security investigations group. And there's one other.
There is one other, which is we're going to be talking to a gentleman who's been living in Australia for 7 years. He's an Afghani Australian who was granted asylum status here back in 2014. He is desperately worried about his family, as so many Afghani Australians are. Just for a little background about this, for those who don't know, that basically the family reunion settlement visa program for refugees, even people who granted refugee status, is completely cut off a number of years ago. So very, very difficult for people who are settled here to reunite with their families. You can imagine with what's happened in Afghanistan in recent days with the Taliban taking over, a lot of Afghani Australians are very worried about the plight of their family. So we're going to be talking to him a little later on. He's going to be using a pseudonym because he is, you know, for obvious kind of reasons, needs to kind of conceal his identity. But we're choosing him to call him Abdul for the purposes of the interview. So hearing from him a little later on. And as Ewan says, yeah, talking a bit about this outrageous, crazy state security raid. Good to see taxpayers' money well spent on dealing with serious criminals like spray painters. So all that and more here on the Indie Media Show. We're going to start with a bit of a track. However, this is Dennis Cometti with No Hat, No Play. We're joined on the line now by Sydney social justice activist Paddy Gibson, who I think it's fair to say can be described as a friend of the Indie Media Show. He's been on the show on a number of occasions over the years wearing various hats. Thanks so much for joining us today, Paddy.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Now, you're, of course, right in the thick of the Sydney lockdown. Let's start with the obvious question, which what life has been like for ordinary Sydney-siders after 2 months of lockdown and at least another month to go. And, I mean, who knows? It's looking at this stage, isn't it? Like it's going to be in lockdown until the end of the year. I know you yourself have a young family. So what's it been like for you personally and you know, I guess more broadly, what life has been like for ordinary Sydney-siders?
Oh, look, well, I'm in a very lucky position where I've got an academic job and I can work from home and keep getting paid, you know, which you know, can't underestimate, you know, how much that means to me in the context of living in a city where there are so many people, hundreds of thousands of people that are out of work, that, you know, in dire poverty, that are, you know, stuck under this lockdown with no support. You know, my partner works at the port. She's been working all the way through this. you know, which has given us, you know, obviously some insight to the issues that, are around, the issues around return to work and the special restrictions and passes and other things that have been put in place on workers, you know, who are continuing to go into work in Sydney. But that doesn't make it any less hard, mate. I mean, we're a lot luckier than, other people, but it's pretty tough being inside for 2 months with young kids and trying to homeschool and work at the same time, and particularly tough when you see that we've got months to go, really, before any of the fundamentals change here. And, you know, there's a vaccination drive on in Sydney, which is now vaccinating people quicker than, you know, anywhere in the world, really, which really shows the capacity that New South Wales Health actually has. But, you know, this could have been done 6 months ago. It's just an, you know, an absolute disgrace that we're in this situation.
Yeah, horse has already bolted in a lot of ways, hasn't it? Now, you mentioned that some people don't have the luxury of working from home. They're forced to physically travel to their places of employment if they're working in logistics or warehouses, various supply chains that are essential to, you know, maintaining services and supply of goods for Sydneysiders, and that's no doubt part of the reason why the outbreak is continuing. There's been lots of debates on the left about the correct approach, and we'll get into that in a moment. But just your comments, Paddy, on the way particularly people in Western Sydney have been scapegoated throughout this lockdown. They're people who have to actually go to work to earn a living for their families, and they've been scapegoated as somehow being, you know, responsible for spreading the virus.
Oh, absolutely. It's absolutely outrageous. Like, the situation that we've got, you know, got here in Sydney is that basically the working class suburbs. I mean, I'm in a suburb called Arncliffe in the sort of inner south, I guess you'd say, but it's connected culturally to the southwest of Sydney. So we're under the, you know, we're under the you know, extreme lockdown that the targeted LGAs are under, along with most of the working class suburbs in Sydney. And, you know, it's obviously, it's multicultural. There's, you know, people from a whole range of immigrant backgrounds, you know, in these communities. So the threat of coronavirus has been really something that's been racialized disgracefully by the New South Wales government, you know, basically trying to describe, you know, cultural difference as somehow being responsible for the outbreak, that people, you know, less likely to follow rules if they're from non-Anglo backgrounds, or more likely to mingle with their family if they're from non-Anglo backgrounds, and this sort of outrageous sort of scapegoating that's gone on to blame for the government's failures. But the regime we're living under is absolutely extraordinary and unprecedented. I mean, what they've basically done is locked the working class in their houses across, you know, across the south, the west and the southwest, with an extraordinary regime where police and military are on the streets. There's checkpoints. You know, as I've discussed, if you want to leave your house to go to work, if you're an essential worker, you now have to get a permit from New South Wales Health. You have to be vaccinated. There's compulsory vaccination. There's compulsory testing. So there's this extraordinary situation where they've just basically turned the screws on the working class and said, we're going to control you with this, you know, regime, and then they'll ration the labour power that does exist into the industries they want to keep going. So construction's, you know, open again. You know, obviously logistics and other things have to continue. You know, we have to feed ourselves. People have to work, you know, on many things. But, yeah, the policing, the racism, you know, and the actual experience, you know, of being persecuted under this lockdown is palpable, is absolutely palpable.
One of the disturbing things for me, Paddy, throughout the entire duration of this pandemic is that you might have a sound or compelling argument to support the deployment of police or even soldiers on the streets for the purposes of maintaining, you know, public health measures. You know, for various reasons, you might support that. But, and it's a very important qualification, you ought to, in doing that, in adopting that position, at least have a very healthy dose of scepticism as to where that might lead in terms of deferring certain powers to state agencies, police, military on the streets. You know, you should at least have a healthy dose of scepticism towards that. But unfortunately, it strikes me that a lot of people on the left, a lot of people in what passes for the progressive community, have, let's say, turned a blind eye to the dangers of deploying the police and the military on the streets of Sydney. So talk a little bit about that, about, I guess, the dangers of the state, you know, accruing to itself these kinds of powers. You talked about checkpoints by the military, et cetera. Even if you support those measures for public health reasons, you have plenty of reasons to be worried, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and I mean, I think it's, you know, pretty extraordinary about faith that, you know, a lot of big sections of the Australian left would go from, you know, abolish the police under the black, in the Black Lives Matter banner last year, to suddenly cheering on a situation where Mick Fuller, the police commissioner here, who is an absolute racist scumbag, is riding high with more powers than any police commissioner's had in Australian history. I mean, the police here can actually order people who are outside the LGAs, if they find them inside an LGA, they can order them home and confine them in their house for 14 days without any reference to any health situation at all. Doesn't matter if they might have been exposed as a close contact or anything like that. Just by virtue of being tapped on the shoulder by a police officer, you now can't leave your house for 14 days. Police have got the power to order entire apartment blocks locked down without any health input at all. It's not on the basis of a New South Wales health advice. It's the police saying that, you know, they might be getting lip or something like that from people on the street. And so they've got these extraordinary powers. And Mick Fuller is saying to his police via media conferences, if you break the law and issue infringement notices unlawfully, I will back you. I will support you. So this is what we've got, open police dictatorship on the streets of Sydney. And I think we need to say, get the police out of the health response at all. There should not be police powers. There should not be a police occupation. What people need urgently is the resources so they can actually live. People need social support. And we need, you know, power actually in the hands of unions and union delegates and, you know, and that sort of thing to take on the issues of safety at work and safety in the community. It's not people and society that is a risk that's going to give you coronavirus. You know, it's particular forms of social interaction that spread the virus. So if people are conscious, you know, if people are conscious of the dangers, if people are empowered to take action themselves, we're going to be in a much, much better situation than what we are now, where people are left half starving, you know, right across Sydney. And, you know, basically you leave your house, you could be subject to police violence and intimidation. So, yeah, I do think, you know, we have paid a very, very heavy price on the left in terms of what the police have been able to do, consolidating their powers through this pandemic with very little critical pushback.
And of course, the science is important and the public health advice is important, but we need to be careful there as well, that there are partisan agendas going on with epidemiologists. It's not as though epidemiologists are putting forward value-free or ideology-free statements and advice to government. Nevertheless, you know, we'd need to take that scientific advice seriously, and there are some epidemiologists who will say that it's possible that we can achieve a zero COVID exit from this pandemic. Other epidemiologists will say that's crazy talk. So that's one of the debates taking place, is whether or not we should be adopting the so-called zero COVID strategy, or I believe there's a campaign starting in Sydney called Lockdown 2.0. So there's some elements of the left, we may as well name them. There's one group, particular Socialist Alternative, who support a very hard lockdown to achieve zero COVID cases, which strikes me as an unrealistic strategy. So just talk a little bit about that, Paddy, to the extent that it's really our place, I suppose, to, you know, that's one part of the debate. Is it really our place to kind of make a decision one way or the other? Should we leave that to scientists and epidemiologists? But then, of course, there are political aspects to it as well, whether we have a harder lockdown, a softer lockdown, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that really needs to be the debate, is around the terms of COVID measures. Which COVID measures? I mean, you know, I think it's a false debate, really, like lockdown to zero versus let it rip. Like, that's a completely false dichotomy. I don't think there's anyone in Sydney who believes we can get back to zero, seriously. Like, I don't think there's any epidemiologist that believes, you know, out there actually arguing Sydney could get back to zero. I mean, this thing's, you know, absolutely out there in the community in a way that New South Wales Health is not on top of. You know, does that mean we want to see COVID transmission? Of course not. You know, and you need to find ways to, you know, keep your workmates safe. But that's the issue here. How do we actually organise to keep people safe? You know, how do we actually organise to ensure there's proper COVID safety plans at work, to ensure there's proper resources in place to allow people to get tested, to ensure that the vaccination drive actually reaches the people who are most at need? I mean, if it gets out, you look around the world, who actually dies from this in serious numbers? it's elderly people and people with underlying health conditions. What a disgrace that in New South Wales, less than 20% of the Aboriginal population is vaccinated this far into the pandemic. That could have terrible consequences. And we're seeing now that we're starting to see the virus getting out in Aboriginal communities. So an enormous amount more needs to be done to actually meet the threat of COVID. There's no doubt about that. Huge, you know, resources are needed at the community level, at the workplace level to keep people safe. But I just think we have to challenge and fight back against, you know, criminalising particular sorts of activity, giving powers to police to roam the streets, you know, unaccountable, you know, whack people wherever they want, you know, under this sort of lockdown regime. I don't think that's anything anyone on the left should be cheering for or should be supporting. We do have to live with the virus. The virus is here in Sydney. How do we do that? How do we keep each other safe? How do we make sure we have maximum vaccination coverage so people aren't dying if they actually get this disease? Those are the questions that are facing activists in Sydney, in our workplaces, in our communities now, I think, you know, rather than, you know, like some fantasy that if we hide inside our houses for long enough, we can get back to zero. We're not going back to zero. So how do we actually say we are going to keep people ourselves as safe as possible going forward?
We'll have to let you go shortly, Paddy. But before we do, just a quick comment on the anti-lockdown protests. The first thing to say is they've been large. They've been large in both Sydney and Melbourne. To mobilise thousands and thousands of people from a legal demonstration is significant. Very easy, of course, to dismiss these people as kooks, as conspiracy theorists, as anti-vaccine nutbags and so on. But is there not more to the story? You know, might it be that some of these people are, you know, surprise, surprise, actually suffering the effects of the lockdown? Not to justify, you know, their particular beliefs perhaps that were on display at those protests, but there's an underlying frustration that is legitimate, I would have thought, for some of those protesters.
Well, look, of course there is. I mean, you know, the leadership of these rallies is often fascist. You know, we've actually got, you know, actual fascists or other unsavoury right-wing characters that are at the leadership, anti-vaccination, COVID's a conspiracy, this sort of rubbish. Like that's, you know, so no, I've got no sympathy at all with, you know, the actual leadership of these demonstrations and what they're doing. But, okay, what has just happened in Sydney last weekend? Someone's just been arrested and jailed for 8 months for organising a demonstration. The organiser of the demonstration in Sydney on the weekend is now in jail, right? An 8 month jail term. Is this acceptable that someone organising a street demonstration is going to go to jail for 8 months? In Melbourne, they used rubber bullets, you know, filled with pepper spray.
And should the left be silent just because they're opposed to what we're... Yeah.
That's right. And then the last thing to say is the other point that you'd make is, I mean, I only know about the social composition of the Sydney rallies. I haven't looked as closely at Melbourne, but the first rally that wasn't as heavily repressed by the police, where people actually came out, there was good chunks of people who came out of the western suburbs because of the economic issues and hardship that they're facing, who turned up to those rallies. And what a disgrace that the far right, you know, is putting up a fight that's actually able to pull some people in behind them who are suffering here. So I think there is a real need. You know, we've got to reject the police powers and we've got to fight very, very hard for the, you know, the real material suffering that people are going through at the moment. Otherwise, the far right will grow.
Absolutely. That's Paddy Gibson we've been speaking to. Thanks so much for your time today, Paddy.
No worries. Thank you.
Yeah, plenty of food for thought there. I mean, this is complex stuff and it's sensitive stuff as well. And I mean, it's sort of worth clarifying that we're in no way giving public health advice or any such thing here on the Indie Media Show. But obviously, and I think this is actually part of the debate itself, is the fact that we should be discussing these things. The fact that they're not, a lot of what we just talked about isn't being discussed at all is, I think, part of the problem.
Well, I think there wouldn't be so many people out of the anti-lockdown protests if they were looked after, if we still had, you know, an increased job seeker program like we did last year.
Absolutely, Joni. Absolutely. And that's I think, one of the key issues that's not being, you know, sort of honestly discussed and acknowledged by elements of the left. Plenty more we could say on that, and we'll return to this topic, I'm sure. But time now for another track.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTRFM 92.1.
Last Thursday, I, along with hundreds of other people, attended the rally at Parliament House, organised by the Kimberley Land Council, in opposition to what's been going on in the consultation, or lack thereof, in the generation of a new Aboriginal Heritage Bill. And I was fortunate enough to be able to record some of the speakers and the speeches. I did miss the Welcome to Country by Pop Ben Taylor, but we'll bring it in the sound that we recorded, and I hope you enjoy it.
Constitution. for us to come together. Now we need to fight for more than black rights. Climate scientists have raised the alarm, and we now need to work together to preserve and manage cultural heritage for the whole community. I wish to culturally acknowledge a great traditional law and cultural leader who is present here today and have led the dancing and the ceremony down there, Mr. Johnny Watson.
One more time.
I had an awful lot of trouble editing down the speakers that presented at the rally. They covered a whole range of topics, so vitally important to hear and understand. But obviously due to time constraints in the program, just had to edit out some snippets there. But Ben Wyatt's involvement in the drafting of the new bill was questioned, particularly with him in the political revolving door now joining the Rio Tinto and Woodside boards. Two companies that are directly responsible for the devastation of some of the most significant art in human experience. As the rally wrapped up, I decided to seek out some of those women that you heard leading the chants and ask them what it meant to them to be at this rally and the contents of it.
Donna Nelson, and I'm a Nyaki Nyaki Balladong woman from the Central Wheatbelt.
What kind of faith do you have, or you know, do you think that these latest rounds of talks with the government are going to result in a Heritage Act that's going to serve Aboriginal people and all of us really in the protection of Aboriginal culture and heritage?
Look, I think as Aboriginal people and state and federal governments, all they seem to focus on is mining and the resources industry. But what we see here in Yungar country, and I keep saying that when mining's obsolete, the greatest damage to our land will be the development, and that's going to be here in the southwest. So when we talk about, as Noongar people, when we look at the attempts of cultural genocide for the last 200 plus years, we still have culture, we're still standing here. But nobody's acknowledging, you know, the contamination to our waterways, our Derbal Yerrigan. When we look at what's actually happened with the dredging for, you know, the likes of Woodside, Elizabeth Keys, you know, those types of things. And I think as Noongar people, we have to get the state and federal governments to understand that, you know, it's not just the mining and resources industry. So, you know, Aboriginal people still live off the land. We can't practice our culture, our women's sites, our birthing places, our ceremonial practices that we would have had when we talk about cultural genocide for us as Noongar people. That has to be considered in the Heritage Act. It has to be considered by state and federal governments, because if not, it's a violation of our human rights. We talk about colonisation and the impact of colonisation, so, you know, we continue to be oppressed as a people, and yet the wealth in this land is not given back to us. So we talk about the disparity in funding to Aboriginal community controlled sector. We talk about, you know, farming back in Kay and my area out in the wheat belt, where, you know, the farmers were made wealthy, but our families live in extreme poverty out there, and the land now is salt, riddled with salt. So we talk about the long-term impact of, you know, the environmental, or the lack of environmental concern from state and federal governments, and I think those are the sorts of things that I'd like to see in any Heritage Act. And I think that people need to look beyond mining and the resources industry and look at bigger picture stuff for us as Aboriginal people if they truly want to talk about what the Aboriginal Heritage Act needs to look like to protect our land for our future generations. Because as a Noongar woman, it pains me to see trees being knocked down, and then we talk about climate change, we talk about basic essentials like that, but that's not being considered at all. It's all, the focus is mining and the mining industry, but we have to look bigger picture.
Thank you. I was just listening. I wasn't really thinking what I was going to ask you. I was just listening to you. Now I've got to try and think of another question. Is there any question you'd like me to ask that you'd like to put forward?
I think that's the biggest issue, is I think that as Aboriginal people, when we talk about our worldview, you know, that needs to be given serious consideration. So, you know, we talk about the dream time, you know, and it happened to be that when we talk about natural disasters, as Aboriginal people with our worldview, we talk about, we think about punishment from Mother Nature. We think about punishment from, you know, our ancestors and those beings such as the Wagal, which is our rainbow serpent. State and federal governments aren't considering that worldview as Aboriginal people. We talk about the cultural genocide for us. We're overrepresented in the youth detention, in the care system, incarcerated. Yet, as a people, we continue to survive that. So we got to look at the strengths, and we got to get that money from the wealth that's coming from our land back and actually bridge that gap between economic wealth for, you know, the rich and wealthy in this country, as opposed to the First Nations people who are the landowners.
How do you see things moving forward? Like, what are the fundamental things that have to happen? Not talking about this law, this act or that act. What are the big picture shifts that we need to have happen?
So the biggest picture shift that needs to happen is we've actually got to smash down the structural and systemic racism and discrimination that continues to oppress us as First Nations people. And I talk about our political systems, I talk about our judicial system, I talk about our economic system, you know, and our social service system. And I think those are the sorts of things that we need to look at, dismantling the discrimination and the bias that continues to keep us oppressed. So we're talking about discriminatory policy, legislation, practice, and I've been advocating and fighting for nearly 40 years, so nearly four decades of fighting for my rights. And I say to government, when I turn 70, you know, I see these elders and I say, that's elder abuse, that we're still having elders sitting at the table, you know, having meetings and advocating for the rights of their future generations. I want to experience what white privilege has, and that is being able to, you know, live as an elder, free from abuse, free from poverty, watch my children and my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren grow up free from discrimination and racism in this country.
Yeah, yeah.
Donna Nelson there speaking to our own Ewan Buckley. Some really important stuff there, and very true what was said there about Ben White. I think that he's got questions to ask his conscience, personally speaking. You're listening to the Indie Media Show. It's about 25 to midday. Thanks so much for listening to RTRFM 92.1, The Sound Alternative. If you've got any comments, criticisms, suggestions, story ideas, do feel free to give us a call in the studio. The number is 9260 9210, or alternatively, send us an email, studio@rtrfm.com.au. Time now for another track. This is the Debbie Downers with Man in a Panic.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
And you're listening to the Indie Media Show. Pleased to be with you. And we're hoping to get Abdul on the line now.
Yep, good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us, Abdul, at what must be a very difficult time for you. Are you able to start by telling us how your family is faring in Kabul? Do you know if they're safe and well, and what life has been like for them in recent days since the Taliban takeover?
Well, thanks so much for having me on the program. Good morning to you and to your colleagues and audience. Yeah, it's horrible news over there. Since Taliban has taken over the country, they're living in shock. They're hiding. What I've done at the moment, right now, my family has been split in three places, hidden. And because I belong to Shia, Hazara, Shia, small minorities over there, the community, everyone, including my family, they have fear of being brutal by the Taliban. That's what happened in the past. And they are alive. And connection is so weak over there. On and off, I can talk to them. Out of four telecommunication companies, three is not working, just collapsed. One is working. My family is lucky that has one of those. Out of four companies, they have SIM card of one of them, so they can contact me on and off through social media. Yeah.
Yes. But so they are safe and well. Thank goodness, Abdul. Now, just to go back a step in terms of a bit more about your own situation. You've been living here for 7 years. You were granted refugee status But I imagine you've tried to get family out here previously, and for those who don't know, it's been terribly difficult, if not impossible, to get granted family reunion settlement visas for people in your situation, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been so hard. I tried, I gave it up because it was not possible. And yeah, recently I became a citizen, so I cannot afford them to bring them over there. As a proposal or something like that, you know. Yeah, sponsorship and stuff like that. The only way is at the moment, because things are so horrible over there, Kabul city is pretty much like a ghost town. The only way that my family members can be saved, they should be evacuated by military planes. That's what is happening right now. That's the only way. Because all the borders are closed, they can go nowhere. And there's no any commercial flight at the moment in the entire country. The only place that people can get out of the country is Kabul Airport, and it's being controlled by international forces, and it's turned to a military airport.
Yeah, now the Morrison government has said it will accept 3,000 Afghan asylum seekers, which is, of course, is nothing like the 20,000 that is being accepted or proposed to be accepted by Canada, the United States and the UK. And I understand the Afghan-Australian community, including the local community here in Western Australia, is calling for Australia as well to take around 20,000 Afghani. So 3,000, it's not enough, is it, Abdul?
It's not enough at all. It's not enough at all, unfortunately, because lots of people will be targeted once the Taliban gets settled. Based on confirmed news, especially BBC Persian, I read the article. They're talking about Taliban is working on gathering data about people who lives where. They're working, their intelligence is working hard, and as soon as international forces, they pull out, they start target killing. Because they just got, and based on some reports, they have access to the biometric at the moment in Afghanistan. They have access to biometric system. If they scan your eyes, if they scan their fingers, you know who you are. If you work for the government or international aid agencies, especially if you have worked as an interpreter and translator for international forces. Lots of people will lose life, and 3,000 is nothing. At least 20,000 will help a group of people who are vulnerable. I know Australia cannot give visa to everyone because there's almost 40 million people living over there. But we need to give visa to people who are vulnerable, and especially those people who helped Australian mission in Afghanistan in the past. Peace-building mission, counter-terrorism mission that Australia had between 2000 and 2021, peace-building, government building, state, nation building, state building. In this mission, when people have helped Australia, they deserve safety. The only thing I want.
There were reports of there were around 100 Afghani guards who were guarding the Australian embassy, and there were reports of them going to Australian diplomats, Abdul, and asking for help and being told, "Well, go and speak to a migration agent." In other words, they were just told to get stuffed, essentially. I know you worked as an interpreter for the Australian Army. Do you feel a sense of betrayal, or people in your situation, a sense of betrayal that Australia has abandoned you?
Well, it's absolutely a sense of betrayal. There's enough evidence that I can talk for hours and hours to find out what's wrong, whose problem, who was responsible for that. I know part of the problem is political side of it. It was irresponsible withdrawal of international force from Afghanistan in such a critical time that war was ongoing in almost all over the country, and there was peace talks ongoing, and international forces just pulled out. It's about sense of betrayal and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, no doubt. So, what needs to happen now in terms of, I guess, what can we do in terms of people listening to this show to support that Afghanis, Afghani Australians? I would think this is one of those occasions where actually writing to your local member of parliament might have a useful effect. And I know there was a rally by the Afghani Australian community on the weekend. So, what can we do in practical terms to show our support and to help get people out here to Australia and hopefully safe, settled lives?
Well, what I do believe is Australian government should evacuate by military plane who are over there in the ground right now and there's enough evidence available. If Australian government does not have connection problem, because interpreters who are already in Australia, our information is with the Department of Defense. They have our profile, they have our contact details, everything they have about from us. If they want, they can contact us, ask details of our family, issue them visa on the spot in the airport, or just take them out and issue them visa in a second country like Dubai. If they want to, they can do it, number one. But if it is a problem of logistics, how to do it. Plus, I do believe Australian government should give at least 20,000 visas to Afghanistan nationals. Bring them here. This is a more responsibility of Australian government. And here in the community, people believe something is wrong. There's a country has collapsed. We need all of us in Australia have moral responsibility to help them, take them out who are at risk. And that's what we need to do. Evacuation, emergency evacuation of those people that Australian at least know who are they, where are they, and they have their contact lists. I know there's a problem. Australian government cannot contact people who are not safe over there. If they want, they have all of these interpreters. They have contact over here in Australia. They can be contact of their families over there. Through interpreters, always settled in Australia, they can contact their families and give them visa or check them out immediately if they want to. That's the pathway they can do it. Plus, yes, there's a lot of shock in the community all over in Australia, over here. Yeah, people are living on limbo. People are living on breaching visas. They don't know what to do. What I want from Australian government is at least give these people a mental peace of mind. Those people who are living on a temporary visa, give them a permanent residency. One. Number two, Australia should give priority to Afghanistan refugees all over the world. In other countries, give them visa to come. Plus, people who have their wife or husband who married went back to Afghanistan, and they're Australian nationals over here, and give visa to these family members because they're family members of Australian citizens or family members of Australian residents. That's all I want from Australian government.
Abdul, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much for your time, and do stay safe, and I hope your family stay safe.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
That was Abdul using a pseudonym, Hazara man, who's safe and well in Perth, but gravely worried about his family who remain in hiding in Kabul. You're listening to the last 10 minutes of the Indie Media Show here on RTRFM 92.1, The Sound Alternative. Time now for another track. This is Novocaine with Leaving in the Sunrise.
You could almost feel the relief through the city of Perth as the six Extinction Rebellion activists known as the Spray Chalk Six were finally apprehended by the state's counter-terrorism unit, the State Security Investigations Group. In a series of post-dawn raids, at least two teams of the State Security Investigations Group conducted simultaneous raids searching activists' houses for items of clothing, cans of spray chalk, perhaps sticks of chalk, and items, devices like phones and computers that may have contained evidence of the alleged crime of writing messages in chalk on the pavement. That's right. The muscle of the State Security Investigations Group was successfully deployed to apprehend these dangerous criminals, including a grandma, a single mother of two who's an education assistant, a children's palliative carer, a disability support services worker, and two students, as they allegedly had drawn messages against Woodside's planned expansion of the Scarborough gas fields in the Northwest Shelf. At a time when the International Energy Agency, the United Nations, scientific consensus is that any new fossil fuel developments such as the Scarborough gas fields pretty much lock in the worst of catastrophes as our planet is hurtling towards 2 degrees and more of warming above pre-industrial levels. We've heard in that recent in that previous session about what real state oppression looks like, and we hear from New South Wales what police powers in emergencies can do. And we're only left to guess why it was that the state's counter-terrorism unit was deployed against six citizen activists for the heinous crime of chalk on a pavement.
Can I ask you to put your other hat on, Ewan? Because, you know, full disclosure, not that we're into really such a thing as a balanced journalism and objective journalism. I think that's a myth. And we could have a long lecture about why the idea of balanced journalism is a myth. But Ewan is, you know, involved in Extinction Rebellion. So I guess putting on your XR hat, Ewan, why do you think the state security unit's gone after these activists? I mean, it seems to me as an act of just naked intimidation, naked bastardry, really.
It's hard to interpret anything different than that, Alex. It could be that really the only opposition to these fossil fuel developments in Western Australia is activism. There is nothing within the state government apparatus. The EPA are approving them seemingly without any kind of checks and balances at all. And so really the only opposition to these corporations doing what they will is activism. And of course, they are some of the primary funders of both Labor and Liberal parties. Without the money that Woodside, Chevron and the likes of them pour into these parties, they can't pay for their election campaigns. And so they're kind of stuck, aren't they? And that's part of Extinction Rebellion's mandate, is to challenge that. And so we need a better way of decision making, because the way it is now, when we have these parties utterly beholden to the fossil fuel companies, has utterly failed. Yeah.
Speaking of which, and I don't know if there were any fossil fuel company representatives there, and I suspect there probably were, and they would certainly be at similar events, but I don't know if you guys saw, it was reported in the West, there was a $5,000 a head private dinner hosted by Nick Satterley from the Satterley Property Group. And there are several, I forget all the names now, but there's about eight people there, all white men, all multimillionaires and billionaires, that were there for a private exclusive dinner in Peppermint Grove at $5,000 a head with Mark McGowan. So they're all businessmen, right? They're all like multimillionaires and billionaires. $5,000 a head with the leader of the Labor Party at a private dinner party in Peppermint Grove.
Well, this is
so
quite
that,
common.
I mean, that speaks volumes about the nature of this government, doesn't it?
The 350.org published a document, a report called Captured State last year, which went into quite a lot of detail looking through parliamentarians' meeting diaries and correlating them with meetings in the fossil fuel industry and donations, according to the Australian Electoral Commission's records. So, you know, in other places in the world, they call it corruption. Here, it's all fully legal, and it's the way that business is done. So really, the only thing that we have left to do is activism. So today, in fact, in about 3 minutes' time, we might even see more chalk being deployed on the pavements at the front of Woodside as Extinction Rebellion activists are gathering to call attention to this.
It's worth pointing out that here at the Indie Media Show, we don't endorse such serious crime as, you know, putting chalk on a pavement. I mean, that's just dreadful.
I would never stoop that low.
We condemn it unreservedly.
As to purchase some landscape chalk from one of our big hardware stores. It's very cheap. And there's plenty of resources available out there to find out what people have been drawing on the pavement.
Well, thanks for tipping us off. We can yeah, stop them now.
That's right, that's right. You can call Crime Stoppers to prevent this heinous crime from taking place. But look, that's about all we have time for here on the Indie Media Show. Thanks to Ewan, and thanks to Lulu, and thanks to Joni as well.
Oh, good to be here.
Yep, I hope you've enjoyed it. It's been good fun, and I've enjoyed it as well. And who knows, I might even be back in the presenter's chair. And that's that all Lulu's have a bit of a cough.
Lulu's just feeling a little under the weather today, so she hasn't been on the microphone. But
that's right. She'll be in the hosting duties next week. But that is indeed all we have time for. Do stay tuned here on RTRFM 92.1. Out to lunch with Rian coming up on your dial. It's been fun as always. And as we say every week, don't hate the media.
Be the media. The media.
See you next week.
And don't forget your chalk.
And don't forget your chalk.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?